The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening, you are listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. We have a very full show this week, our second show of 2016. Helen is going to be talking about Derren Brown. She went and saw Derren last year in December and has sent us in a nice little review. I unfortunately had to Google who Derren Brown was as I listened to her review, which was slightly embarrassing. But, you know, I know who he is now, so that's fine. We're also going to be hearing a scary story as a part of our live scare slam that happened last November. And obviously we're going to be playing you episode 2 of Great Expectations, but not before we do this. The Matt Boothman and Vicky Weston Retro
Film Review. So good I put my trousers back on.
This is another retro review. Vicky and I have just watched Old Boy by Chan-wook Park. It's a Korean movie from 2003. It's part of the director's Revenge trilogy, or Vengeance trilogy, I think it is. So it's kind of a revenge mystery, this one. So Oh Dae-soo is kidnapped off the street on the night that he's out drinking and imprisoned for 15 years and then mysteriously let go. And so he wants revenge on whoever locked him up, but he also wants to find out why he was locked up in the first place. So it's a revenge thriller, but it's also a mystery. It's kind of a detective story. And also there's a thread running through of what does he really want? Does he just want revenge? Does he just want to hurt and kill the person who locked him up? Or does he want to know the whole truth? And so there, he's given opportunities throughout to sort of make that choice. It is an unremittingly horrible and dark and movie full of like full body cringe moments.
Yeah, it's quite painful to watch, and I don't think we'll do any spoilers on this one, even though it was quite a long time ago, because there's been a recent remake and people may still yet to be seen to see either of the versions.
Yeah, so that was 2013 with Josh Brolin in the lead.
So we won't go into any spoilers, but there are a few kind of twists and turns that are sort of that shocking, where you can feel your kind of like stomach curling up on itself inside your body. So it's that kind of film. It's pretty unrelenting in its ability to kind of shock and disturb you, but at the same time really character driven. Like, it is a really character driven film, so it's not like a kind of horror movie where they're trying to just shock you with kind of gore and things. It's more about the kind of awful things that are happening to a person that's what's shocking.
Yeah, and the little that you see of him before he's kidnapped, he's this very kind of doughy, drunken, a bit of a mess of a person. And when he comes out, it's like the room that he's kept in is his crucible, and he comes out this much tougher, more driven person. And so he does ask himself at one or two points, do I actually, you know, if I get my revenge, do I want to go back to being the person I was before? Can I go back to being the person I was before? So that's one of the questions through it. And the horror is, it's a movie with really strong motifs. Like, the horror is pretty much all mouth-related. So there's a lot of teeth stuff and sort of eating specific things, specific scenes that you may have heard about. And there's what we kept talking about. There's a purple pattern that keeps cropping up that is kind of the bad guy's signature.
It's kind of like, it's like a hallmark for him appearing when he's a kind of faceless, nameless entity at the beginning of the film, and then as he's identified later in the film, it becomes more prolific, and he's really using it as a calling card and as a way of demonstrating to Oh Dae-soo how much control he has over what's happening to him. And just when you think Oh Dae-soo has kind of got out from under his thumb and is winning for a moment, you realise that actually there's still another layer where he's still in under the control of the baddie, who's called Woo Jin Lee, who we won't go into this too much, but they're supposed to be of an age, and he looks way, way too young. But he was very, very good.
Yeah, he's sort of shown taking very good care of himself, whereas Odesu does say being in that place for 15 years has really aged him, but it's still quite a stretch.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a stretch. But the kind of nemesis character of Wu Jinli is, I mean, really, really strong characterization. He's got all of the kind of classic tropes that you might expect from a kind of supervillain. He's very wealthy. He has a fancy wardrobe that moves in mysterious ways. but he's also got there's actually quite a lot of like deep-seated like psychological trauma that's happening under the surface.
And the one thing I will say that could be construed as a spoiler is this is part of the Vengeance trilogy. Odesu wants revenge, but he's not the only one in the movie who is out for revenge.
Yes, that's without giving away any spoilers. Yes, actually,
so there's sort of two revenges meeting head on.
Yes,
and it's which one might win out.
Yes, you have this sort of I'm taking revenge on you, but I'm taking revenge on you, and
your revenge quest was planned out as part of my revenge quest.
Yes, it's like revenge one-upmanship, Korean style.
Yeah,
and it works really incredibly effectively because that's that same thing about these two characters, which are actually sort of trying to wrestle control of the situation from each other.
Yeah.
And actually you kind of come to realise that one of them is much more in control than the other. And some of it has that slightly like super villain-esque, and I planned it all the very beginning.
And there are certain parts sort of involving hypnosis that I find a little bit of a stretch.
Kind of far-fetched.
But I think it's a trope of the genre, that really elaborate revenge. But I did find myself going, really, in a couple of places.
There are a couple of bits where, like many good thriller movies, things have to go exactly the way that the supervillain intended them for it to really work.
Yeah.
And you know that in real life, that's really not how it happens. Yeah. But it works.
Yeah,
it totally works.
It's all in service of getting to those big choices and those sort of climactic moments. So I'll forgive it because it's in service of getting to a good place or a dramatically interesting and potentially horrifying place.
Yeah.
Should we talk a bit about the sort of the direction and the fight choreography?
Yeah.
And that, so it's got a lot more kind of interesting camera work and specifically kind of scene transitions that you don't see a lot in a lot of other cinema. So the sort of the wipes between scenes, but also sort of clocks rotating in or calendars rotating in and then rotating out again. There's a lot of interesting kind of split screen work with reflections and sort of a close up on someone, close up in reflection on one side of the screen with somebody far away also in the reflection on the other side. And these sort of dualities are brought through quite strongly.
Yeah, they do some beautiful comparison work between Odesu and Wu Jin by having their face half and half and then kind of melding them together on the screen to kind of show that in some ways they've kind of like done the same things or are trying to. So they're both trying to get revenge. They've both kind of been guilty of some of the same things and they're kind of showing that comparison.
Yeah.
There are some really clever cuts as well that I really like where they'll cut, everyone's very still a lot of the time in the film, and there'll be a focused camera on like two people being still, and then it'll cut and they'll have just jumped to a different position in the same room, and then they'll cut and they'll have jumped again to a different position. So instead of showing a smooth transition of somebody walking from one place to another, it's just three still shots. And I noticed that a lot. There was a lot of stillness in the film.
Yeah, and a lot of actually cameras just panning at a perfectly fixed rate, sort of off a character and onto another character, and then onto the first character again, who has moved back round to where the camera was going to arrive. It's quite it keeps a lot of stuff hidden from the viewer to surprise you.
Yeah,
which I suppose is it's kind of the experience that he is having of having a lot of stuff hidden from him. Specifically, and there's the talking of the sort of the side-scrolling camera, there's a particular fight sequence that is brought up quite a lot in discussion of this movie, which is almost like a side-scrolling video game.
Yeah.
Going along a long corridor, which has been very... This is the interesting thing about talking about this movie 12 years after it came out. That scene has been very influential on fight choreography. You can see a lot of its influences in the Daredevil TV show on Netflix. And you watched John Wick,
yep.
and that's yep. that. I,
Incredibly similar. Yeah, there were a lot of similarities. There were actually a lot of similarities in colour in John Wick. They use a lot of that grey-green colour and then purple as well. And Old Boy is very much those colours kind of mixing together to create an atmosphere. I noticed in Old Boy, and I think this was true of John Wick as well, and I think this is, you do see quite a lot of this in kind of... in kind of like kung fu movies and stuff, is like a real focus on a particular color.
Yeah.
And there was quite a lot of that, like a like kind of giving a color to certain areas that kind of translated to that character or indicated that character or indicated a certain part of the storyline. And color in the room that Odesu is kept in is quite prominent as well. But there are a lot of interesting camera work. I think if you watched it just for the different camera work, like whether it's this side scroll or whether it's this cutting or whether it's split screens, you could probably write a really, really long list of all the different techniques they employed. But it didn't seem like it was smacking me in the face with it.
It's not a really showy directorly piece,
yes.
Is it?
No, it's not going, it's always, look at these clever cuts that I'm doing.
No, it's always in the service of an effect.
Mm. And that's what it was like in John Wick. You didn't feel like the director was kind of pushing it in your face. And if there's anything they'd taken from Old Boy, it was that we can use these things in a quite theatrical way, in a really cinematic way, or in a way that really services the fight choreography. You know, like, I think that side-scrolling is a much better way of showcasing how that kind of fight choreography looks and works than being right in the middle of the action does. Whereas if you're just throwing punches, being in the middle of the action, fair enough. But if it's something as beautiful as a martial art form, you want to be able to see that whole thing playing out. And I wonder if that's partly why they were influenced to kind of do it that way. So you were seeing the wide shot of everything happening.
Yeah, I'm really interested to watch Sympathy for Lady Vengeance now, which is another one in this trilogy, partly because Old Boy is so much about men. It's all the women are kind of either their victims or justifications or vehicles for the men's stories. So I'm interested to see how the same director takes on a female-led revenge story.
Yes, that will be that would be really interesting to follow up with that. Do you know anything about it?
I only know the title and that it's on Netflix.
Oh, brilliant.
Netflix thinks I will like it because its algorithm has brought it up for
Netflix
me.
Netflix may be correct. So they've remade the film. They've remade Old Boy in kind of classic American filmmaking tradition. They've gone, here's a perfectly excellent film with subtitles in another language. We should remake it in the English language so that people who probably wouldn't bother to see a film in Korean will watch it. I haven't seen it. You haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it because I don't feel like I need to.
Yes, I feel like that. I had a quick look at the synopsis on IMDb. It's basically exactly the same, but with, I think, less octopus eating. But, you know, we can wait and see on that one. I think I would be interested to see it just to see what they've done with it, see if it's even possible to do something new with it.
Whether they have tried to do anything new with it or whether it's just
purely
to bring it to an audience who won't or who the studios perceive as not wanting to watch subtitled movies.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because like Josh Brolin, he's a fantastic actor and I can really imagine him succeeding in that role.
Although I doubt he would have such artistically unkempt hair.
No, I can only imagine.
Min-Sik Choi, who plays Odesu.
It's absolutely brilliant. His hair is like a co-star in the film because it's so... it kind of switches between this kind of totally mad hack job haircut.
Because it's being cut by kidnappers
Idiots.
Rather than hairdressers.
And it is pretty awful, but it kind of speaks to his like dishevelled
his
personality, and state of mind, rather than just his outward appearance.
That was Matt and Vicky reviewing the film Old Boy, which I watched one year, wasn't last year, it was the year before, I believe, on New Year's Eve. And it's not really the kind of film you want to be watching on a fun, ringing in the New Year type night. It was very strange, especially when he ate the octopus. No spoilers, but there is an octopus that gets ingested. If you like that kind of thing, go and watch Old Boy. So the next thing we're going to be hearing on the Blackshore Arts Hour tonight is a scary story by a wonderful writer named Alison Cuff. Now, she performed this last year at Blackshore's first ever Scare Slam. This is a live recording of that night.
Our next storyteller is the fabulous Alison Cuff. Hello. So the story I'm going to tell you tonight is, for the most part, with a little bit of artistic license and a little bit of fudging around the edges too. And I've called it Little Voice. I'm 43 years old and I still sleep with the light on and the TV. I avoid the dark and the silence at all costs. I'm afraid that I'll not live to see the light again. All started at the Top of the Pops and that god-awful song that everyone was going mad about at the time. I'm going to try not to think about it now because I'll get an earworm. But it was about a lion sleeping in the jungle. Even at the tender age of 10, I knew crap when I heard it, so I decided now was the time to go to the toilet before Corrie came on. Hopping up the stairs, two steps at a time, that's when I first heard it. It was a half whisper. Hello, it said. That's all. Just hello. It only just flickered in my consciousness the first time I heard it. The second time, however, I heard it clearly enough. The third, well, that was really loud. Forgoing the loo, I stumbled back down the stairs, feeling a presence staring at the back of my neck. I spent the rest of the evening trying not to pee. The events that occurred later that night would be etched into my brain forever, even down to the most insignificant details. The position of my bed, the shard of moonlight piercing what would have been otherwise an inky blackness through the thin patches in my velvet curtains. We lived in the country, so it was always pitch black. I can even now I can point out where the slough is in the night sky, no matter what time of the year it is. I was sat up with my bedclothes pulled up and held under my chin to keep warm and staring with some confusion at a writer's bureau of the type I always wanted but didn't actually have. Until now, apparently. Hello. I froze, straining to hear it again. Silence, the only thing in my ears being my own heartbeat, thundering. Perhaps I imagined it. Yeah, that was it. It was a cat or an owl. Belatedly remembering that I did actually have to breathe, I pretended to relax now, lying down and sliding my head under the bedclothes. Hello. And then, I know you can hear me. I snapped up, bolt upright, suddenly plunged into terror. I took in the small blue white light circling the bed. Go away, I tried to yell, but found my voice paralyzed in my throat. Leave me alone, I screamed almost wordlessly. The blue-white light responded anyway. All right, I'll go away. But when I return, I'm going to kill you. And then I woke up. With mouth dry and heart jumping out of my chest, I knew there was no way in heck I was going to go back to sleep that night. I spent the rest of the night tossing and turning with my bedside lamp on. But it was just a nightmare, and life carried on as usual for the next few weeks. I went to school, did my homework, showed my father a new computer game I'd managed to write with Dragon 32. I did try to sleep with the bedside light on, but my mother noticed a couple of days later and told me off. To my relief, all was well, and I shrugged it off, and that was that. But then it happened again. The setup was the same. It was night. I was in bed, and the moonlight was still struggling through the curtains. I was half believing I was still awake. Hearing a noise, I reached out to switch on my lamp, and my hand just passed straight through it. Staring at it, tried again. Whoosh. I didn't understand. It looked solid enough. Normal. And then I thought, oh, hang on, I've fallen asleep again, haven't I? It was at this point that the lamp began to transform. It turned white. I felt intrigued, wondering what my over-imaginative imagination would produce for me next. As I looked on, it gradually changed shape until, after what seemed to be a minute or so, it resembled a little human, short and fat, side on. Suddenly, it turned to face me. Hello, it said. After that, there was just the red eyes rushing towards me, screaming death. Another night spent wide awake with the light on. This time, I reached out for Eden Blyton and wondered numbingly if the Secret Seven was going to save me. Sadly, they didn't. Instead, the voice started to return every night and invaded my life for the next Lord only knows how long. It began as soon as it was dark. Little voice, I called it. Hello. 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 I used to hum to myself to pretend I didn't hear it. And when that didn't work, I used start to chant, "Mummy, Mummy, Mummy," until after no doubt driving up the wall, she would run upstairs and tell me off. And that was okay for as long as I was chanting or for as long as she was in my room shouting at me. I couldn't hear a little voice. It was only temporary relief, of course. The whispering started up again as soon as she stomped back downstairs. "What do you want?" I finally plucked up the courage to ask. "Come to your mum and dad's bedroom," it said. "No," I hissed back, immediately imagining being pulled through a portal into a terrifying alternative world. I squeezed my eyes tight and blocked my ears. "I won't do what you say. I won't." But it just kept asking over and over, that night and all other nights after that. I used to bury myself under the bedclothes the moment I got into bed. I didn't ever dare take a single peek for fear of seeing the blue white light again. Then, one night, I decided I had enough and I was going to do something about this. So I asked it to stop. "Just stop." "Okay, only for now, the little voice replied. "You aren't allowed to come back until I say so." "Okay, well, how will I know when you say so?" We made a deal. I said that they couldn't come back for as long as whenever I went up or down the stairs, I stepped up or down the first step twice. Amazingly, they agreed. As you can imagine, I religiously stepped up and down the first step of any flight of stairs for years. No, I don't do it now. I guess we'll go out of that. I don't remember. I eventually put it down to an over-vivid childhood imagination. Mum told me once, years ago, after we'd moved, that a little girl had died after falling down the stairs in that house. But I do sleep with the light on still, and preferably the TV or radio, even now, particularly now. When I looked up the house, using Google Street Maps to prepare for this evening, I saw a faint image of a face, a girl's face, with red eyes, in the window of what used to be my mum and dad's room.
Lovely stuff. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Alison. I have never had the horrible experience anywhere I've lived. Closest I think I came was when I was very young, and this was not a... I don't know, maybe it was a reaction to the getting out of bed and sleeping underneath it thing, but I used to have quite a large bed when I was small, and obviously when I was considerably younger, I was even smaller than this, if you can believe such a thing. And in the course of being asleep, obviously you're, you know, head on the pillow, feet facing downwards, etc., I actually was able to turn entirely round 180 degrees. And so there were at least three or four occasions I remember when I woke up with my head facing the bottom of the bed. And when your sheets are tucked in, for a few seconds, it is still the worst sensation I have ever had in my life. Oh, good. I've been buried alive. I was asleep. And, then I obviously pulled my head out of the bedclothes, and it was the most relief I've ever felt in my life. And so, you know, swings and roundabouts. So we're going to have another break now. 10, 15 minutes.
That was Alison Cuff telling a very scary story that she performed at Blackshaw's Scare Slam last November. Now we're going to move into Helen's lovely review of Derren Brown, Miracle.
On the 5th of December 2015, I went to see Derren Brown at the Apollo Theatre in London's glamorous West End. I will say now that the show is ongoing and it's touring lots of places around London, Canterbury, Cambridge, etc. in the new year. So if you want to go and see it but you can't get there before the first couple of weeks of January, then just go and book. Because it's a really good show. If you're half considering it, then get yourself down there, because my opinion is it is best to see Derren Brown in smaller venues anyway, so not seeing it in London is worth it. And it's probably, if you've seen Derren Brown before, any of his stuff, you might remember the show Enigma. It is the best show since then, I think. I'm now going to try and talk about it with as few spoilers as I can, but the reason why I've said all of that information up front is because if you want to go, I want to make sure that you don't hear anything that's going to wreck it for you. You know, that's part of the little Darren Brown Club shtick that he does to make us all believe him a bit more, which is excellent. I'm going to tell you a bit about the show, but as per my usual style, it will probably tell you more about me than it does about him. I've seen every live show that Darren Brown has ever done. I remember when I was much younger, when I was in my early teens, I would be at home on a Friday night because I'm cool, and Darren would be on TV and I would just be besotted. I remember watching Eurotrash and Graham Norton then as well, but I think that's probably another story and much more confusing. But Darren, that was it. It's love. You know when it's love, don't you? So since then, I've just basically been following him around. That's why I can confidently say that this is one of the strongest things that he's ever done. Clearly, his heart is really in the subject matter. The second half of the show focuses on a theme that he's previously done a television programme about, and that's really excellent. Like, it's not just him playing around. He's in there and proving a point on an emotional level. He's not just toying with you. Like, there's bigger stuff going on there. The show has got this really beautiful overarching theme about the power of the mind and about how you can use that for good. Obviously, he has known and he's been teaching us for years that the mind is a powerful thing, and, you know, just a little bit of trickery or whatever. I don't know how things are done and I don't care, just to clarify. I don't want to know. In this show, he uses that, and he's sort of talking about the mindfulness concept of negative self-talk. So this show is really perfectly timed, either accidentally or on purpose. He's got Andy Nyman on board again, who some of you will know from doing Ghost Stories in the West End, and they are a dream team. So this is, it's just incredibly fun. It follows the normal Darren Brown format of the first half being those little tricks that you might remember him doing with celebrities on the TV a while ago, or where he just embarrasses the audience as much as he can, really. And the second half gets a little bit stronger, a bit darker. However, there is a difference this time, and there's a thing where he had one member of the audience, a woman, the night I saw it, and they sit on stage together one-on-one, and they have this incredible experience. They do something, I won't tell you what it is, that is just completely mind-blowing. And he looks at her at the end and says, if somebody had said to you that you were going to do that this evening, would you believe that you would do it, that you could do it? And she said no. And there's something beautiful about that, the fact that he took us on this journey and tried to show us that we're not entirely what our minds will tell us, and that if we use the power of our minds in the right way, we can change how we see the world and be happier for it. And I think it's quite nice for a show not only to be fun and to make you happy in the moment, but actually to try and send you away with a way of making yourself happy afterwards. I'm really glad to see Darren doing that as well, because his recent shows have been darker at the end and left you with a slightly stranger feeling, so it's nice to come out on a high. I would highly recommend going and seeing a bit of magic or a bit of illusion or whatever live on stage. I know that Vicky has or will be sharing with us her experience of another West End magic show, and I do think it is different to other stage shows. Everything takes you on a journey into your imagination, but magic does that in a way where you're caught between the real and the unreal, and I think it's quite nice to sort of let go in that way and trust the performer on stage. I think I've probably said enough, but this isn't a sales pitch. I do really love Darren Brown, and I think he's excellent, and I think it's great that magic is having a bit of a revival overall in recent years, kind of led by him. There's some other excellent magicians out there as well. Who would I recommend you go and see? Oh, yeah, go and see Chris Cox if you like the mind-bending stuff. And if you like sort of more conventional magic, go and see Piff the Magic Dragon. I don't know exactly when he is going to be in London, but he's just done really well on America's Got Talent, and he's so funny. He's really charming. In a way, I think Piff in his dragon outfit with his dog, also in a dragon outfit, is potentially a magician for people who think they don't like magic. Inverted commas. So have some fun, guys.
So as Helen was mentioning in that review, unfortunately, Derren Brown's show Miracle is not playing in London currently. It finished literally yesterday for January 2016. However, if you do want to go and see him, he is playing the likes of Canterbury, Milton Keynes, Brighton and High Wycombe in February. So get along and see him in a smaller venue if you like magic. I don't think I could go and see a show like that because I get really frustrated by magic. So I won't be going to see Derren Brown. Anyway, moving on. A couple of weeks ago, at the end of 2015, essentially, on our last live in the studio show, Matt and I were talking about all of the films that we have reviewed on the show. So Matt reviewed a whole bunch, and Vicky stepped in and reviewed a couple as well over the whole course of the life of the Blackshore Arts Hour. We have actually reviewed 27 films so far. And what I said to Matt was it would be quite interesting to see which of the films pass the Bechdel test and which don't. So for those of you that don't know, the Bechdel test is basically, it's like a three criteria thing. So the film must have at least two women in it, they must talk to each other, and they have to talk to each other about something other than a man, which doesn't seem that hard. But a lot of films do actually fail it. It's sort of a tongue-in-cheek kind of way to establish whether a film is feminist or is supportive of feminism. But it's sort of, it's not really a very good representation of that, I don't think. And I'm telling you that because I've gone through and I've got two numbers of which of the films we did pass and which of them don't pass. And I'm so surprised. So basically, it's 18 films out of the 27 that do pass the Bechdel test, and 9 which don't pass. But it's actually going through the films that do pass that's a bit confusing. Like the likes of... just it's not so much confusing, it's just things that I didn't think were going to pass, because I don't see them as particularly, you know, feminist films. So, you know, the likes of Fast and Furious 7, Jupiter Ascending, 50 Shades of Grey was just one that I was like, really? So, yeah, that's the research that I conducted into all of the films that we have reviewed on the Blackshore Arts Hour. And it is quite in favour of the Bechdel test, and a lot of the films we did pass them. So, well done, all the films were reviewed in 2015. Now, to coincide with what I'm ranting about here, I've picked one of my favourite arts things of the week from 2015, and this is talking kind of about the gender gap within media, whether it be film or on the stage. Here's Vicky.
This week, actually it was last week, I started to find that lots of articles and things about the same topic were cropping up in my sphere of attention, mostly on the internet. But it was when I read an article in Stylist magazine on the tube on the way home the other week that it kind of really came to a head. And it was about a film that's due to be released on the 12th of October called Suffragette, which I'm sure would make for excellent reviewing on the film review one week, if we can fit it in.
Noted.
And it's got an all-star cast of ladies, including Kerry Mulligan, Romola Garai, Helena Bonham Carter, Anne-Marie Duff, Meryl Streep. Do I need to go on? Probably not.
No.
Didn't know Romola Garai was in it.
Everyone's in it. If you're not in it, then what's the point? Obviously, Meryl Streep's playing Emmeline Pankhurst, but the story's really focused on a working-class woman played by Kerry Mulligan and how she's kind of drawn into the fight. But anyway, the reason that I'm bringing it up is, of course, Stylist magazine were interviewing them about the film, but they also asked them about their perceptions around the kind of gender problems in the film industry, of which there are many and too many to talk about right now. But one of the things that really jumped out at me, and this is as a result of seeing these kind of other articles crop up, is that there's a particular issue that actually had kind of escaped my notice, and I feel a bit shamefaced about it. And I feel like it's summed up by this amazing quote from Emma Thompson, who is one of my favourite actresses of all time because she's totally awesome, where she says, "I remember someone once saying to me that I was too old for Hugh Grant, who's like a year younger than me in Sense and Sensibility, and I said, do you want to go and take a flying leap?" And firstly, I'd like to say props to Emma Thompson for being a legend, but that this calls to my attention an issue around the age gap between men and women in film.
Oh, yeah.
And what I'm really frustrated about is not just the fact that this problem exists, but that I hadn't really noticed it. And
really?
That I kind of find embarrassing. Well, I'd noticed it in some things, but there are quite a lot of films that I then found in this BuzzFeed article where I was like, oh yeah, oh my goodness, I've seen that film. And when I watched it, I didn't think, why is this woman playing opposite a guy who is like 30 years older than her? For example,
I feel like, hang on, just before you go on, have we spoken
we
about
have,
this?
We have, and
Matt?
I'm just trying.
What
just
movie was it in relation to?
I'm just trying to work that out.
Was it when we put a poll out on Twitter and we were trying to? No, that wasn't it. We asked everyone what age that they thought someone was.
It was Tom Cruise.
It was Tom Cruise,
and he was starring with his co-star in Mission Impossible 5. And
who was about 20 years younger.
Who was about 20 years younger. So she's a really good... This is a really good example of a recent one, right? But one of the ones that actually I want to call people's attention to is a film that's just come out called A Walk in the Woods, where Emma Thompson, who is 56 years old, is playing opposite Robert Redford, who is 79. So it's not just a problem that young actresses are facing... This is a problem that all female actresses seem to be facing in any film they're in. That it's totally... And I'm not saying there's a there are plenty of people who are in genuine relationships who have a 20-year age gap. I'm not calling into question the kind of legitimacy of that. It's just that there obviously is this problem whereby they look at Robert Redford and say, who's a suitable romantic partner for him? It has to be someone who's in their early 50s. And I just... I kind of find that surprising.
I've seen graphs of this.
I'm going to mention graphs. Okay, so Vulture.com...
We're coming to graphs, Matt.
Coming
Quiet
to
down.
Graphs. So, obviously, we've got to see the research that backs this up, right? So, Vulture.com... and this might be the same set of graphs, but I'd be interested to know if it isn't, have done a set of graphs that charts a particular leading man in their films that they've been in and their age that they were as they were in them. So obviously that's just an upward trajectory. And then the age of their female co-stars, and obviously it shows the age gap because there's a blue line for them and a pink line for the ladies. And it's fascinatingly revealing that the age of the man just continues to go up, obviously, because he's just getting older, and the age of the women either stays roughly the same or actually in some cases gets younger,
which is
kind of fascinating. But anyway, what this BuzzFeed article did, which I quite enjoyed, was that they gender swapped it. So they took examples and then said, so if, for example, in A Walk in the Woods, where Robert Redford is opposite Emma Thompson, if we were to flip that age gap, he would need to be paired with an actress who was 23 years older than him, and that would make her 101. Or, for example, in Get Smart, where Steve Carell, who's 46, was paired with Anne Hathaway, who was 26, if they were to flip that, he would be starring opposite Barbara Streisand. It's like, these examples are just fantastic, and it really kind of makes you laugh, and you kind of think, actually, that's really ridiculous. And it's like, well, hang on a minute, why is it only ridiculous in the way round where the woman is much older than the man?
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Vicky for all of the hard work that she puts into her arts things of the week. And hopefully in 2016 we can look forward to a little bit more of a balance in terms of gender and how it's portrayed within the film industries and in theatre. Now, moving on to our highly anticipated episode 2 of Great Expectations. This is Great Expectations, adapted for the radio by Marcus Baisley.
Pip, an orphan, is living with his older sister and her husband, Joe Gargery, the blacksmith. Pip has encountered two escaped convicts on the marshes surrounding his home. After he has helped one of them to food and drink, the convicts have been tracked down, captured, and returned to the prison ships.
Great Expectations, Episode 2. One night, I was sitting in the chimney corner with my slate, expending great effort on the production of a letter to Joe. I think it must have been a full year after our hunt upon the marshes, for it was a long time after, and it was winter and a hard frost.
I say, Pip, old chap, what a scholar you are, ain't you?
I should like to be.
Why, here's a J and an O equal to anything. Here's a J and a O, Pip, and a Joe!
Ah, but read the rest, Joe.
The rest, eh, Pip? One, two, three. Why, here's three J's and three O's and three Joes in it, Pip!
Why didn't you ever go to school, Joe?
Well, my father, Pip, he was given a drink. And when he were overtook with drink, he hammered away at my mother and me, most unmerciful. Consequence, my mother and me, we ran away from my father several times, which you see, Pip, were a drawback on my learning. Consequence, my father didn't make objections to my going to work. So I went to work at my present calling, and I got acquainted with your sister. As to you, if you could have been aware how small and flabby you was, dear me, you'd have formed the most contemptible opinions of yourself.
Never mind me, Joe.
But I did mind you, Pip. When I offered your sister to keep company, I said to her, and bring the poor little child. God bless the poor little child, I said to your sister. There's room for him at the forge. Hey, ever the best of friends, and us, Pip. Don't cry, old chap.
Now, if this boy ain't grateful this night, he never will be. It's only to be hoped that he won't be pomp-eyed, but I have my fears.
She ain't in that line, Mum. She knows better.
Mrs. Joe and Uncle Pumblechook burst into the room.
She?
And she is a she, I suppose. Unless you call Miss Havisham a he. And I doubt even you'll go so far as that.
Miss Havisham uptown?
Is there any Miss Havisham downtown? She wants this boy to go and play there. And of course he's going, and he had better play there or I'll work him.
Well, to be sure. I wonder how she came to know Pip.
Noodle! Who said she knew him? Couldn't she ask Uncle Pumblechook if he knew a boy to go and play there? And couldn't Uncle Pumblechook, being always considerate and thoughtful for us, then mention this boy, standing prancing here that I have forever been a willing slave to? Uncle Pumblechook, being sensible that for anything we can tell, this boy's fortune may be made, and has offered to take him with his own hands to Miss Havisham's. And Laura, mussy me, here I stand talking to mere moon calves, and with Uncle Pumblechook waiting, and the boy grimed with crock and dirt from the hair of his head to the sole of his foot.
Within a quarter of an hour, we came to Miss Havisham's house. Satis House was of old brick and dismal, and had a great many iron bars to it. There was a courtyard in front, and that was barred. So we had to wait, after ringing the bell, until someone should come to open it. A young lady came across the courtyard.
What name?
Pumblechook.
Quite right.
This is Pip.
This is Pip, is it? Come in, Pip. Oh, did you wish to see Miss Havisham?
Only if Miss Havisham wanted to see me.
Ah, but you see she don't.
Oh.
My young conductress locked the gate, and we went across the courtyard. The cold wind seemed to blow colder there than outside the gate.
Don't loiter, boy.
We went into the house by a side door, and the first thing I noticed was that all the passages were dark. We went through more passages and up a staircase, and still it was all dark. At last we came to the door of a room.
Go in.
After you, miss.
Don't be ridiculous, boy. I'm not going in.
The only thing to be done being to knock at the door, I knocked, and was told from within to enter. I found myself in a pretty large room. No glimpse of daylight was to be seen in it. It was a dressing room, as I suppose from the furniture. In an armchair sat the strangest lady I have ever seen, or shall ever see. She was dressed in rich materials, all of white, and she had a long white veil, and even her hair was white. I saw that everything within my view, which ought to be white, had been white long ago and had lost its lustre and was faded and yellow.
Who is it?
Pip, ma'am.
Come nearer. Let me look at you. Come close.
It was when I stood before her that I saw that her watch had stopped at 9:20, and that a clock in the room had stopped at 9:20.
Look at me. You are not afraid of a woman who has never seen the sun since you were born.
No.
Do you know what I touch? Here.
Yes, ma'am.
What do I touch?
Your heart.
Broken! I sometimes have sick fancies, and I have a sick fancy that I want to see some play. There. There. Play. Play. Play! Are you sullen and obstinate?
No, ma'am. I am very sorry for you, and very sorry I can't play just now, but it's so new here, and so strange, and so fine, and so melancholy.
So new to him, so old to me, so strange to him, so familiar to me, so melancholy to both of us. Call Estella! Call Estella, at the door!
Estella! Estella!
Let me see you play cards with this boy.
With this boy? Why, he is a common labouring boy.
Well, you can break his heart.
What do you play, boy?
Nothing but beggar my neighbour, miss.
Beggar him.
It was then I began to understand that everything in the room had stopped, like the watch and the clock, a long time ago.
He calls the names Jax, this boy, and what coarse hands he has, and what thick boots.
You say nothing of her. She says many hard things of you, but you say nothing of her. What do you think of her?
I don't like to say.
Tell me in my ear.
I think she is very proud.
Anything else?
I think she is very pretty.
Anything else?
I think she is very insulting.
Anything else?
I think I should like to go home.
And never see her again, though she is so pretty.
I'm not sure that I shouldn't like to see her again, but I should like to go home now.
When shall I have you here again? Let me think.
Today.
There! There! I know nothing of days of the week. I know nothing of weeks of the year. Come again after 6 days. You hear?
Yes, ma'am.
Estella, take him down. Go, Pip!
I was so humiliated, hurt, spurned, offended, angry, sorry. I cannot hit upon the right name for the smart, God knows what its name was, that tears started to my eyes. At the appointed time, I returned to Miss Havisham's, and my hesitating ring at the gate brought out Estella.
You are to come this way today. Well?
Well, miss?
Am I pretty?
Yes, I think you are very pretty.
Am I insulting?
Not so much so as you were last time.
Not so much so?
No.
She slapped my face with such force as she had.
Now, you little coarse monster, what do you think of me now?
I shall not tell you.
Why don't you cry again, you little wretch?
Because I'll never cry for you again.
We went on our way upstairs, and as we were going up, we met a gentleman groping his way down.
Whom have we here?
A boy.
He was a burly man with an exceedingly large head and a correspondingly large hand. His eyes were disagreeably sharp and suspicious.
How do you come here?
Miss Havisham sent for me, sir.
Well, behave yourself. I have a pretty large experience of boys and you are a bad set of fellows. Now mind, you behave yourself.
We were soon in Miss Havisham's room, where she and everything else were just as I had left them.
Are you ready to play?
I don't think I am, ma'am.
Since you are unwilling to play, are you willing to work?
Yes, ma'am.
Then go into that opposite room and wait there till I come.
I crossed the staircase landing and entered the room she indicated. From that room, too, the daylight was completely excluded, and it had an airless smell that was oppressive. The most prominent object was a large table with a tablecloth spread on it, as if a feast had been in preparation when the house and all the clocks all stopped together. A centrepiece of some kind was in the middle of the cloth, and as I looked along the yellow expanse out of which I remember it seeming to grow like a black fungus, I saw speckled-legged spiders with blotchy bodies running home to it and running out from it as if some circumstance of greatest public importance had just transpired in the spider community.
This is where I will be laid when I am dead. They shall come and look at me here. What do you think that is? That? Where those cobwebs are?
I can't guess what it is, ma'am.
It's a great cake. A bride cake. Mine. Come, come, come. Walk me, walk me. This is my birthday, Pip. On this day, long before you were born, this heap of decay was brought here. It and I have worn away together. When the ruin is complete, and when they lay me dead, in my bride's dress, on the bride's table, which shall be done, and which will be the finished curse upon him. So much the better if it is done on this day. Let me see you two play cards. Why have you not begun?
When we had played some half dozen games, a day was appointed for my return, and I was taken down into the yard and left to wander about as I liked.
Hello, young fellow.
Hello.
Who let you in?
Miss Estella.
Who gave you leave to prowl about?
Miss Estella.
Come and fight. Stop a minute, though. I ought to give you a reason for fighting, too.
In a most irritating manner, he pulled my hair, dipped his head and butted it into my stomach.
Oh, there it is. Now, laws of the game, regular rules.
I judged this pale young gentleman to be about my own age, but he was much taller. My heart failed me when I saw him squaring at me. I never have been so surprised in my life as I was when I let out the first blow and saw him lying on his back, looking at me with a bloody nose and his face exceedingly foreshortened. I am sorry to record that the more I hit him, the harder I hit him. But he came up again and again and again, until at last he got a bad fall with the back of his head against the wall.
That means you have won.
Oh, can I help you?
No, thank you.
Good afternoon.
Same to you.
When I got into the courtyard, I found Estella waiting with the keys.
Come here. You may kiss me if you like.
I entered on a regular occupation of walking Miss Havisham round her own room and across the landing and round the other room. It was at once settled that I should return every alternate day at noon for these purposes. We went on in this way for a long time when, one day, Miss Havisham stopped short as she and I were walking.
You are growing tall, Pip. Tell me the name again of that blacksmith of yours.
Joe Gargery, ma'am.
Let him come soon. And come alone with you.
It was a trial to my feelings to see Joe arraying himself in his Sunday clothes to accompany me to Miss Havisham's.
You are the husband of the sister of this boy.
Which I mean to say, Pip, as I up and married your sister, and I were at the time what you might call a single man.
Throughout the interview, Joe persisted in addressing me instead of Miss Havisham.
And you have reared the boy? With the intention of taking him for your apprentice. Is that so, Mr. Gargery?
You know, Pip, as you and me were ever friends, and it were looked forward to betwixt us as being calculated to lead to larks.
Have you brought his indentures with you?
Well, Pip, you know. You yourself see me put them in my hat, and therefore you know as they are here.
You expected no premium with the boy. Pip has earned a premium here, and here it is. There are 5 and 20 guineas in this bag. Give it to your master, Pip.
This is very liberal on your part, Pip, and it is as such received and grateful welcome, though never looked for, far nor near nor nowheres.
Goodbye, Pip. Let them out, Estella.
Am I to come again, Miss Havisham?
No. Gargery is your master now. Gargery, One word. The boy has been a good boy here, and that is his reward. Of course, as an honest man, you will expect no other and no more.
In another minute, we were outside the gate, and it was locked, and Estella was gone. It is a most miserable thing to feel ashamed of home. Home had never been a very pleasant place to me because of my sister's temper, but Jo had sanctified it. Now it was all coarse and common, and I would not have had Miss Havisham and Estella see it on any account.
Jo, don't you think I ought to make Miss Havisham a visit?
Well, Pip, what for?
What for, Jo? What is any visit made for?
There are some visits, perhaps, as forever remains open to the question, Pip. But in regard of visiting Miss Havisham, she might think you wanted something, expected something of her.
But, Jo, here I am, getting on in the first year of my time, and since the day of my being bound, I have never thanked Miss Havisham, or asked after her, or shown that I remember her.
That's true, Pip.
What I wanted to say was, if you would give me half a holiday tomorrow, I think I would go uptown and make a call on Miss Esther de Havisham.
But your name ain't Miss Esther de Havisham, Pip, unless she have been rechristened.
I know, Jo, I know. It was a slip of mine. What do you think of it, Jo?
With what absurd emotions I found myself again going to Miss Havisham's matters little here. Everything was unchanged, and Miss Havisham was alone.
Well, I hope you want nothing. You'll get nothing.
No, indeed, Miss Havisham. I only wanted to let you know that I am doing very well at my apprenticeship and am always much obliged to you.
There, there. Come now and then. Come on your birthday. Aye, you are looking round for Estella. Abroad. Educating for a lady. Far out of reach. Prettier than ever. Admired by all who see her. Do you feel that you have lost her?
When I arrived back at our kitchen, I found it was full of people. And there was a surgeon. And there was Joe, on the floor, in the midst of the kitchen. They drew back when they saw me. And so I became aware of my sister, lying without sense or movement, where she had been knocked down by a tremendous blow on the back of the head, dealt with some unknown hand. Nothing had been taken away from any part of the house, but there was one remarkable piece of evidence. She had been struck with something blunt and heavy, and on the ground beside her was a convict's leg iron which had been filed asunder.
Now that has brought us to the end of yet another Blackshaw Arts Hour. We are going to be back with you again on the radio on the 31st of January. It is our first live show of 2016, so everyone's going to be back in the studio with me. Matt will be back reviewing a film, which is a surprise at the moment. I'm yet to be aware of which film he is going to be reviewing. Vicky will be back throughout the course of the year with her arts things. And Helen and Ellie will be making appearances every other week. So tune in next time, in a fortnight, for another episode of the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio.